Hi, Dave.
Hi, Eliza.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Well, thank you for joining me today. Hi, guys. Dave and I are have no idea what we're doing, and we're going to figure it out as we go, so bear with us. Today we're going to discuss a couple of topics that I've picked out on Reddit, and we're going to be approaching it from a therapy point of view. Dave and I met a few years ago, and he told me about this amazing thing called REBT, which completely transformed my life. And ever since then, I've been wanting to create something that could help other people the way that it helped me. And Dave very kindly agreed to join me. So here we are, and we're gonna try to figure it out. Dave, can you tell everyone a little bit about yourself and about REBT?
Sure. Well, about myself as a, how it relates to REBT, I have an educational background in clinical psychology. I didn't end up pursuing it as a profession, but I guess I kept up with the literature and I ended up digging into everything and falling back in love with the teachings of Albert Ellis, who discovered or created REBT, which stands for Rational Emotive Behavioral Therapy, which is the original form of cognitive behavioral therapy. Others is Aaron Beck's cognitive therapy. And I guess the main takeaway of that type of therapy or life philosophy is that it's not events in our lives that cause us to experience unpleasant emotions and behave in maladaptive ways, but it's what we tell ourselves about those events. And particularly when we tell ourselves irrational things in the form of demands and basically distorted statements. And that really revolutionized the field of clinical psychology, because prior to that, the dominant therapeutic approach was, Freudian psychoanalysis. And as far as efficacy, they really weren't breaking much ground. And Albert Ellis, who was a psychoanalyst and quite an adept one, was getting frustrated with his practice. He was saying patients were getting better after the session, but they ultimately weren't getting better in totality. And how he came upon this approach was diving back into philosophy, which was his hobby, and digging into the works of philosophers like Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius, who in antiquity were essentially practicing these same methods, and he encompassed it in a clinical approach and essentially a life philosophy. And
Interesting.
I think it's exceptional.
So, can you tell me a little bit about the difference between REBT and CBT?
So CBT, which stands for cognitive behavioral therapy, is actually a category of therapeutic approach. A lot of people confuse it for type of an actual therapeutic practice. And I think that got confused because the two main leading types of cognitive behavioral therapies were REBT, which was Albert Ellis's cognitive behavioral therapy, which he was the first in the field. And then about a decade later, Aaron Beck created Beckian cognitive therapy, which was the other leading one. And the person who really popularized Beckian cognitive therapy was Aaron Beck's, one of his leading students, which was David Burns. He wrote a book called, oh my God, it's not coming to mind. I think it was Thoughts and Feelings. And that really blew up. And I think it was in the 80s, and he was on all the talk shows. And that really popularized cognitive behavioral therapy as a practice in general and self-help books. And I think people just thought of that approach as cognitive behavioral therapy, and they just called it that. And what most people, I guess, are treated with when they go to a psychotherapist is usually some form of a cognitive therapy. REBT is not as commonly seen. It got, I guess, pushed out of the spotlight because of, I think it was because of David Burns and the popularity of his books and his, I guess, marketing campaign. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, as partial as I may be to REBT. And also, Ellis spent more time training psychotherapists than he did really marketing, you know, not just marketing, but also publishing papers, which Aaron Beck came from a medical background, as did David Burns. They were psychiatrists. And because they were publishing, they really got more of the spotlight, and particularly in terms of health insurance, because it was showing that, you know, Becky and cognitive therapy was effective as psychopharmacological interventions like SSRIs. And that really meant something, because, you know, prior to that, the health insurance companies were kind of turning tail on having shrinks, you know, basically paying money for shrinks because they were dropping a lot of cash in the 60s, or, you know, prior to this stuff. And they were running the numbers saying, look, we're covering you for 5 sessions a week of psychoanalysis, and, you know, you still register as having symptoms of depression and anxiety. You know, we're basically just going to cover things like Valium and Prozac and whatnot. And then suddenly comes along these new therapeutic approaches, like, again, therapy and RABT. And now suddenly there was empirical evidence behind them that would motivate a health insurance company to cover those sessions, which is the case to this day. And a lot of that was thanks to people like Aaron Beck, who was publishing these papers that I believe was used to encourage the health insurance companies to, you know, put money behind.
But is there much of a difference between the two, or are they essentially the same thing, just marketed in different ways?
No, I mean, this is why I'm partial to RABT. I think RABT goes particularly deeper, and I think it's because it's rooted more in a philosophical approach as opposed to, I want to say, a medical approach like the Beckian, but the Beckian cognitive therapy focuses more on identifying cognitive distortions, and REBT is focusing on getting to the root beliefs beneath it that is causing the unwanted negative emotions, unhealthy negative emotions like depression, anxiety.
What's a cognitive distortion?
So a cognitive distortion is things that humans do, and Aaron Beck came up with an official list of these, where we'll do these things like one is all or nothing. We'll you know, fool ourselves to think that. Let me think of an example. Oh God, like black or white thinking. Like I either get this job I'm applying for, or it's the end of the world. There's no in between. And that's not in line. It's this distorted way of thinking. It doesn't comport to reality. And again, the big thing with cognitive behavioral therapy is about reality testing your thoughts. Because if your thoughts are out of line with reality, the theory goes that you are going to cause disturbance in your emotions. And if your emotions are, and again, this is where the cognitive part, you're thinking, the behavioral part is not only are, you know, the cognitive part is going to interact with your emotions, but also you're going to behave in maladaptive ways. So if you're thinking in irrational ways and distorted ways, obviously you're going to feel bad, but logic dictates you're going to start to behave in ways that are self and other defeating. You may develop substance abuse habits. You may become violent. You may self-harm, so on and so forth.
If we were talking about this in an REBT versus CBT form, say I call you and I say, oh my God, Dave, if I don't get this job, it's the end of the world. This is the job I want. This is the job I need. And this is the one and only job for me. If you were approaching it from CBT versus REBT, what would the difference be in how you would tell me to approach that problem?
So I'm going to disclaimer, I am not trained thoroughly in Beckian cognitive therapy. I am pretty thoroughly knowledgeable of REBT, so I can talk to how an REBT therapist would approach that. My guess, and I think it would, it would probably be a factor of what kind of other cognitive behavioral therapist you're working with. The REBT therapist would quickly identify the statement you're saying and then ask you to provide evidence for that comporting with reality. So like you just said, if I don't get this job, it's going to be the end of the world. Well, then prove it. You'd have to provide evidence that that's the case.
Yeah, that the literal world would literally end.
Yeah, and as you go through that exercise and realize that it's based in nothing, and really keep going through that process until you internalize that understanding, you viscerally internalize it, eventually your brain's going to give in and realize this is based in nothing. And the emotions that have been fed, whether it's a sense of anxiety or maybe depression because you're feeling hopeless, those emotions are going to start to dissipate. They're going to go from, you know, maybe the anxiety downgrades from an unhealthy negative emotion like anxiety to a healthy negative emotion like concern, because now your belief is altering to something that's in line with reality, where it goes from the belief that it's going to be the end of the world to it's going to suck, but it's not the end of the world because life goes on and there still are other possibilities for me to get a job that could be in line with something I want, or maybe something better, or maybe I'll end up getting that job at another point in time. All those statements are true, or they're all possibilities. Now we're talking, we're leaving the realm of certainty. And by the way, now switching my hat over to the Beckian cognitive therapist, they'd quickly identify you're using the cognitive distortion of fortune telling, because you're talking about a future that you literally can't predict. Because as far as we all know, we've yet to find someone who has proven the ability to absolutely predict the future. That's a cognitive distortion that we see in most humans. You know, if you really think about it, we all fall into that from time to time, where we start acting like fortune tellers and we really believe we have that power. Like on some level, and we literally drive ourselves crazy.
Yeah, I intend to do that sometimes.
You know, and you know, I'm sure some people listening to this will, if they really think about it, they'll say, "Yeah, I'm actually doing that." Like, I know I'm literally not a fortune teller, but I can think of times where I have upset myself as if I literally had that power, and if and that is. That is the essence of a distortion. It's you know, information distorts when there's conflicting information crashing into itself. So with someone like David Burns or Aaron Beck, they'd point that specific thing out to the client. And the therapeutic intervention would be when the client realizes they're committing that distortion often. The idea is once they realize they're doing that, they keep an eye out for that and catch themselves from kind of employing that kind of distortion. So, and they start kind of build a whole list of distortions that they're known to do and catch themselves. REBT goes deeper. REBT realizes that there are certain inherent irrational statements that Albert Ellis identified that is likely to be inherent in all humans and is probably rooted in an evolutionary psychological basis. And off of those, we build these unique stories. You know, a lot of it is based in rational statements, but a lot of it is based in irrational statements. And a lot of it is taught to us from, you know, either from our parents, from society, from friends. And a lot of it we create ourselves. You know, we just observe things and make shit up. Well, and
I found that like, I found that the what you're talking about with, for example, the job is terrible. Losing the job is terrible. I found that having a more complete feeling of, well, this story that I'm telling myself is irrational is a lot more useful than just saying that I have a specific cognitive distortion towards, like, I have a tendency to fortune tell. Like, that tends to be a more difficult thing to deal with for me than just noticing that the thought that I am having is irrational at its core, instead of trying to identify what the irrationality is. I don't know if that makes
sense. Well, actually, I just had a thought as you said that. So I'll show you how REBT could go deeper. Mm-hmm. So sure, as you said, you're saying, oh my God, it's going to be the end of the world if I don't get this job. And by identifying the distortion, you've now realized you have this tendency to do this fortune telling thing, and now you've unlocked this cheat code where now every time you catch yourself doing that, you can quickly stop yourself from
believing,
basically
the thing I made
throwing
up.
Yourself into a tizzy. However, REBT as you were saying that, I'm thinking beneath that is a belief that there's probably a statement under there that I need to eat to get this job. Like, why? I'm thinking, why do you even need to get this job? There's a story beneath that you've created for yourself that has lines and lines and lines beneath it. There's a whole story that goes all the way down to a root belief that's irrational, and layers of irrational beliefs built upon that. And REBT wants you to go down that entire tree of beliefs and destroy all of them. That's, you know, it's, I mean, essentially it's see the old philosophers do in their meditations, like Marcus Aurelius's meditations. You're getting to the root of these ghosts and demons we create in our own heads based on stupidity we create for ourselves. So from there, I'm hearing, oh, I need a job. Well, why do you need this perfect job? Well, because I need to be meaningful. Well, why do I need to be meaningful? Well, I need the approval of others. Why do I need the approval of others? Well, because I need evidence that I'm a good person. Why do you need, what's a good person?
Someone that everyone approves of.
Well, let's start with a good person. Well, how, that's impossible. That would literally be a person that is good in the subjective opinion of all people under all conditions at all times. Now, this gets to something Albert Ellis identified, this inherent belief that all humans seem to have. I must be good. He talked about this. He said all humans have these things called the three musts. Mm-hmm. I must be good, others must be good, and life must be good. We just have this, just it's built into our firmware. And from that, and they're irrational beliefs. And, you know, a lot of people hearing me may believe they're not. But if you take each one of those statements, they are not true.
Well, what's the difference between, like, saying I must be good as an irrational belief and what you're saying is it's okay to be a bad person?
So, well, let's start with I must be good. So the big thing in REBT is the way you identify an irrational statement is seeing if there is a demand versus a desire. Mm-hmm. And the way you know if it's a demand is if there's a, in, you know, language that would imply a demand, must, should, ought, as opposed to a statement of preference. I would like it to be. I desire it to be. I'd prefer it to be. So now let's just take apart the idea of I must be good, a good person. Just even the concept of a good person, as opposed to a person who commits deeds that most would consider good very often. That's something that's real. That's something we can understand. But a good person, it's impossible to rate a human being in total. It's impossible. We're too complex. If you really take the time to think about it, deeply think about it, because now we're getting to the philosophical depth of something like REBT. Again, it, like I was saying a few moments ago, it would be being that across all time, in the subjective opinion of all humans that have ever existed, under all conditions, would be doing something considered good always. It's an absurd concept. It's a Jehovian being. It's impossible.
But surely what you're saying makes sense when the distance between the people is like you and me. Deciding who amongst the two of us is good and who is evil is tough. We're similar. We're of a similar age, similar background. There's too much that we have in common to really, you know, I've done my share of stupid things. I'm sure you've done your share of stupid things. Ultimately, we probably balance each other out. But when you're talking about the distance between somebody who is, I don't know, a nun who is saving children every day and a mass murderer.
We're talking too low resolution now, though. And I think this is a big mistake that humans have made for a long time. And I think our society right now is really making that big mistake, is we're thinking in terms of total evaluation of a human as opposed to focusing on deeds in general. Mm-hmm. So in terms of a mass murderer, the deed of murdering a lot of most people, including myself, would consider an extremely reprehensible deed.
Right.
Like it's just irredeemable. We don't need to go into the whole, for instance, you can have a human being that has, so how would, I'll give you an example. Let's take a story of a person from day one who has just cured cancer, saved children, pet a million cats, loved every person, and then he just killed a million people. Is that person good or bad?
Huh.
So that's the point. If you take the deeds as they are and evaluate them, that's what matters. It's impossible to rate a human being as a whole, and I think this is where we get into trouble. Now, especially when it comes to the pursuit of justice, and you know, and then going back to this statement that's baked into our brains, and I think Albert Ellis was onto something, and I think evolutionary psychologists, which I'm not, would probably have a lot to offer in this department, and may be able to, you know, validate Albert Ellis's hypothesis or not. And but that I think that's what that comes from. This I must be good. I imagine it's something that allows humans to actualize rather than just sit there and, like other animals in the animal kingdom, just sit there and you know, follow their base survival needs of eating and procreating. Because the thing is, unlike other animals, we not only think, but we are able to think about our thinking. We do more than just survive and reproduce. And we have this desire to actualize. Go ahead.
But like, a lot of what we talk about is about feeling better about life and existence and just my own, well, for me, my own well-being on a day-to-day basis. And it's super helpful when I'm faced with things that are not even black and white. It's the opposite of black and white. It's very helpful with things that are a little bit gray, right? I'm friends with someone and I don't know if I want to be friends with them anymore. Am I a bad person for no longer being friends with them? Well, REBT is really helpful in like saying there's no such thing as a bad person and it's okay to decide that a friendship isn't working anymore. But when it comes to things that are bigger or that have had a larger impact on a larger number of people, isn't using this just a way to explain away bad behavior
so that I've been doing? I think you misunderstand how REBT would be used in that case, because it's not used to explain it away. I think in the case like you described, often people would, because they're demanding that they be good, and if they did something they're conflicted about, and said, I shouldn't have done that, I shouldn't have cut off a friendship or something, they'd likely create the unhealthy emotion of guilt, which and by the way, I'm going to point this out. So something REBT does, which I believe the other cognitive behavioral therapies do not, is make a distinction between healthy and unhealthy negative emotions. Healthy negative emotions being concern, whereas the unhealthy negative emotion that's on the same spectrum would be anxiety. A healthy negative emotion is sadness, an unhealthy negative emotion is depression. So in this case, the unhealthy negative emotion would be guilt. And what makes it unhealthy is it's not serving you any good. It's hurting you. It's weighing you down. It's usually resulting in maladaptive behavior, meaning that you're not productive. You may be engaging self-defeating behavior, other-defeating behavior, self-defeating in the sense that, you know, maybe you're not going to work, you're abusing substances, whatever. But anyway, in that case, because you're holding this belief, I shouldn't have done this thing. Again, shouldn't, a demand, not I wish I hadn't done it. That's different. That's a desire. You have now obsessed over this thing and you have made yourself feel guilt. REBT would point that out and then get you to dispute that. Argue against that statement until you believe you have basically propagandized yourself to no longer believe the propaganda that you've propagandized yourself to believe in the first place.
I have an example. I'm making this up, but it's close enough in two situations that I've seen in reality that it works. Say I am up for a job and my friend is up for the same job. We both need the job as much as the other. Both of us financially could could use it. It is as important for both of us. And mm-hmm. we're both as qualified and steal the job by doing mm-hmm. something. It doesn't matter. I send an email saying my friend is a thief or whatever. It doesn't matter. I do something that guarantees that I get the job and my friend does not. Objectively, this is not a good thing to do. It removes the...
Well, not objectively, because there's certain people on the planet who will think that's okay. Now, why? In your opinion, in my opinion, which I share your subjective opinion that it's not a good thing to do. But right. go ahead.
But I've done it. I've got the job. And now I'm walking around like I'm the worst person ever. And I stole a job from my friend. And I'm skipping work. And I'm not performing to my best. Like,
correct. So let me just stop you there, because there's yeah. a lot of things going on. So you said you're the worst person ever. That's global evaluation. That's already something that's a distortion. So globally evaluating yourself is already an irrational thing to do. Because like we said, RABT points out that you can't globally evaluate a person. And what that's going to result in likely, if you globally evaluate yourself as negative, is giving birth to a much more powerful negative emotion than guilt, which is shame. Mm-hmm. Because shame is basically the emotional version of the acknowledgement that you are inherently broken, flawed, bad. Guilt is the emotional version of obsessing over, I've done something terrible. So here would be the healthy version. And here's the irony. Guilt and shame result in the person not only not doing anything about the bad deed and the bad things they're obsessing over. Often people who are awash in guilt and shame, they end up repeating the offenses over and over again.
Interesting.
Because they're just because here's the logic. If I'm murderous, lecherous piece of shit, well, what does murderous, lecherous pieces of shit do? They just keep murdering and stealing. Yeah. And ripping off their friends anyway. And then, oh man, I did it again. I just feel terrible. It just becomes self-serving. It's like this internal penance. You become your own, what's it called? The
executioner?
The booth you go into. I can't believe it.
A priest?
Yeah, the confession. You're your own confession booth in your own head. You're just doing that constantly. Now, as opposed to healthy emotion to guilt is healthy regret. Mm-hmm. It still hurts. So in the case where you basically screwed over your friend and got the job, and then you reflect on it, and then you really regret it. Now, and there may be consequences too, as you're found out, and you just face that reality. The regret will likely result in you not doing it again, which is a good thing.
Right.
Because then you'll avoid doing that again in the future. And also you'll likely feel good about the decision you make and making good on it. And there may be good, it's just going to be tangible benefits down the line. The way you get to healthy regret is rather than saying, I shouldn't have done it. Because again, if you shouldn't have done it, which that's not in line with reality, you did it. That's the argument against I shouldn't have done it. You say to yourself, I did it. And it sucks, right. But I better accept it, and I better move on, and I better accept the consequences that come with it, and I better focus on figuring out how I don't do that again. That's the healthy dispute.
But wouldn't and that be excusing it? Like, to me, that feels...
No, because that's actually... Now you are getting ready to... You hear the part where I said accepting the consequences, because you know consequences are coming. Mm-hmm. Because reality is reality. There's no escaping that. Again, that the irony is our ego creates that internal confession booth where we think by making ourselves guilty and ashamed, because they're painful emotions, we think that self-flagellation or flagellation, I know flagellation is fart on yourself, but flagellation, whipping yourself, whatever the fuck it is. It's this weird thing we do where we think that pain is enough. But I suspect it's a way our brain's trying to get us off easy. It's a weird thing, because otherwise people would just quote unquote, do the right thing, if there was ever such a thing. Because they're not acting like they talk. Because again, if you really look at people, it's like the classic case where they keep saying, oh my God, I'm so terrible, I did this, and I do it again. Albert Ellis has an excellent lecture, a rare lecture that's available on YouTube. It's from the 60s. It's called On Guilt and Shame. He talks just about this. And you just, but the demanding that you didn't do it, it's accepting that you did it. And that's the real honorable thing. It's taking ownership of it, regretting it, and then putting all your energy to making sure you don't do it again. Because, I mean, to me, that's what matters. I don't care. I mean, I care that it was done, if someone did something to me. Well, what matters to me more is that evidence that they're not going to do it again.
Right.
Because what's done is done. But now I want to know if this is going to happen again, especially if I'm going to continue interacting with this person. All right. The words
instead
is,
of
I'm
sitting
sorry.
Around crying and screaming, I'm sorry.
Yeah, they can
and
grovel all they
person.
Want, but like, honestly, yeah. That stuff makes me suspicious because, you know, talk is cheap. And then, no, also from a clinical standpoint, the guilt and shame, those are bad signs, because I know that that's self-serving. They're spending all their energy, you know, beating themselves up, and that's energy taken away from them reflecting on what they did wrong and how they are going to stop that next time. So Albert Ellis in REBT says, absolve yourself of all this pain emotionally and use that energy to get to work and focus on changing your habits and your mindset to a healthier and more, you know, rational and reality grounded mindset. So again, your guilt turns to healthy regret, and then your shame, you know, what would be the flip side of shame? Basically, shame turns into one of the main practices within REBT, which is unconditional self-acceptance. And this is often confused with what people call, you know, unconditional love or self-esteem. It's not to be confused with that. It doesn't mean that anything goes with you. It just means you are accepting the reality of who you are with all your flaws and everything. And that doesn't mean consequences won't befall you. It's just realizing that you are what you are, no matter how much you want to, you know, wail and moan about it and say this shouldn't have happened, or I shouldn't have done this, or I shouldn't be this. It's just, you know, accepting yourself in totality. And that same goes for other people, and the same goes for the world itself. It's just accepting reality, because once you do that, reality is going to be what it's going to be, including ourselves and other people in the world. Then we can get down to business and start doing whatever we can, move ourselves in the direction we desire, encourage others to move in the direction we desire them to move, and shape the world to the best of our ability. That's all we can do. Instead of demanding, I should have done this, I should be this, demanding other people, you should believe this, you should do this, demanding the world should be this way. We're wasting time. It's ridiculous.
Okay, well, what about the other way around? The same scenario, my friend and I are applying for the same job, have the same level of need and the same level of interest and the same level of education. But I get the job because I'm the one that's selected. And then my friend comes to me and they accuse me and say, you stole the job and you're a horrible friend and you knew how much I needed this and you should have stepped away. You knew that you would get selected. You're whatever, prettier than me or smarter than me or whatever. It doesn't matter. And they're like, you should have stepped back. You should have just let me have this job. And instead you stole it, even though no actual act of stealing took place. And in this scenario, mm-hmm. I didn't send an email. I didn't do anything to guarantee myself the job. It just happened to come to me. How would one deal with those kinds of accusations?
The law of shoulds in there. So if someone,
I know.
Someone suspected you of stealing their job when you literally didn't?
I would say not even suspected, but accused. I'm thinking more along the lines of, well, relationships that are similar. I have a very special mother. Relationships that are similar to my relationship with my mother, where the pain of the loss is so big that she'll put the responsibility onto me instead of taking the responsibility onto herself.
Okay, so it's, yeah, I mean, and again, I think, you know, it depends on the person. And it sounds like in this case, if the person has, you know, acute pathology, that's going to be different than someone who might not. So it really depends on who you're dealing with and how confident you are they have the ability to even take responsibility for, you know, their role in it, if you can prove it to them or not. In that case, that's not really a matter of a therapeutic intervention. I think that's more an issue of how you communicate.
I guess actually, the reason that I'm asking is because that was one of the things that took me so long to kind of get over, the ability to hear accusations in my direction, especially from my mother, and to just dismiss them. The endless times that she'll come to me and say that I'm a bad daughter, to learn to just not take her opinion of who I am into account. Well, first of all, because there's no such thing as a bad daughter, as we have already discussed.
Good. Yep. That's step one.
Because a lot of what she says is not really a reflection of reality, but that took me a long time to see. And I guess what I'm asking is, often when we get accused of something, even if the accusation isn't real, I see it in myself and I see it in my friends. There's this like jump to take responsibility for things that are not our responsibility. And so I don't know what to suggest in those situations.
I'm trying to figure out what the issue is here. So someone's accusing you of something
that you didn't do.
Is the issue that they have an issue with you? Is the issue that you're worried they're going to retaliate? So
I don't know. Yeah, I guess the issue is that you feel guilt, like at least me, I would feel guilty for, I don't know, we would go to an event and my mom would say, you stole all the attention. And okay, I would feel guilty. Let me stop you for a second
because this is a good opportunity to point out two things. I think I heard Michael Edelstein, he's an RBT practitioner, a student of Dr. Albert Ellis. He mentioned a distinction between practical and emotional problems. He likes to separate the two, and I like that. I don't know if he was the one who made that distinction or if that was Ellis. In this case, it sounds like the issue is more in the emotional realm, which means you're creating the issue. A practical issue would be you're worried about retaliation. So if someone's like, if someone's saying, hey, you accused me, and now you're worried about them killing your cat, that's a practical issue.
Right.
And then it's really a matter of strategy. So we've ruled out the practical issue. So then it really has nothing to do with your mom, and all the power falls in your hands. It doesn't really matter what your mom's thinking or doing. You mentioned something of feeling guilty. Well, there's an unhealthy negative emotion, and beneath that is some kind of belief, which has to do with something about your action or a belief you held about her. And it's just a matter of isolating that belief in terms of the statement you're saying, and let's rip that statement apart, and that's how you end it.
But I guess when we're being accused of bad behavior, it's so strange. It's really interesting. I see people respond to those kinds of accusations with complete and utter responsibility, when sometimes they're not really responsible. An accusation like you purposefully took all of the attention in the room it's not real. It's not
accusation. I think that often happens, especially with parents to children, is because of the thing I said earlier. I think one of the biggest fallacies that's built into our belief system is I need the approval of others. And in particular, I need the approval of people I think are important. And usually one of the people think are most important are their parents and loved ones. And if you can destroy that belief, which is false, we do not need the approval of others. That doesn't mean we don't want it. And it doesn't mean it's not good to get the approval of others sometimes. But if we believe we need it, we are going to be a slave to approval, and often to our detriment, and often to the other people's detriment, because we're giving power to people, especially if people are pathological, that's not good for them and not good for us. So in that instance that you're describing, it's not good for the other person, because if it's coming from a place of pathology, it's just enabling maladaption on all ends.
But I completely agree.
But the people you're describing, they're allowing the shitstorm to continue because they believe they need the approval. So in that case, they're getting a voice of disapproval and uh-huh. they're upsetting themselves unnecessarily. And then they start say shit to themselves. And the buck would have stopped.
Interesting. So they're responding to the disapproval rather than responding to the accusation, essentially.
Correct. It's basically this person that I have deemed important is a judge that I've made a judge early on because it's an important person. And the judge is doing Caesar's thumb down to me right now. Mm-hmm. And as every time I see Caesar give me thumbs down, that's devastating. It doesn't matter. And Caesar knows when Caesar gives thumbs down, Caesar has my balls in a vice. And that's why Caesar does thumbs down to me all the time. And that's what mom is doing to children. I see it all the time. And when I say children, I'm talking people in their 30s. It's a lifelong of emotional bondage. And it goes beyond parent to child. I mean, it's across the board. This is, you know, the term shaming. I mean, people unironically think that is a good thing because a lot of power comes with it. But again, like I was saying, you know, you don't want to necessarily give control to pathology, even though in the moment that power may yield immediate benefit. When it all plays out, eventually the whole, you know, house of cards is going to come toppling down and everyone's going down with it, including the person with the pathology. So, yeah. You know, impulsivity and all that shit, it just has a tendency not to work out very well. But yeah, so, but what I see in those cases is it's banked on two things, the need for approval. And beneath that is the core must, you know, one of the three musts. I need to be good. Because if you didn't believe you need to be good as opposed to I want to, you know, I want to live a meaningful life. And if you really started thinking deeply and realize I can never truly know what is universally meaningful, but I'm going to do my best to observe the world and listen closely and try to build a philosophy of meaning. And I'm going to work hard to observe other people, you know, again, not ideally if they're observing a philosophy like RABT or, you know, the Stoics, whatever, not absolutely follow everyone, but try to find people with consistency and listen to them, you know, pattern after people who have proven repeatedly to bear fruit in their lives and set examples and accomplish things and that I want to accomplish. I will, you know, draw inspiration from them rather than needing their approval. I'm just going to follow certain examples and keep updating my internal library of values. And every now and then, if someone who really is impressing me gives me positive feedback, that's going to really affect me on a deep level. And I like that. And if they give me negative feedback, that's going to hurt. Yeah. And I'm okay with that. But I'm also ready for that pain, but I don't need it not to be the case. Yeah. So again, this is not to be mistaken with a world where the disapproval doesn't hurt. That's the thing. RABT, you will feel these emotions deep. In fact, you will feel these emotions. What's the word I can use? You will feel the real emotions. They will be deep. What we are feeling in the irrational world, and I think people could kind of get it when they feel depression and all that. It's, they feel strong because they're so overwhelming, but they're not.
Yeah.
They're running you. You're not running it. When the emotion is driven from philosophy that you built by your rational thinking, because you've built a life philosophy, you're not reacting to the world. Mm-hmm. You're not. Then when you're feeling the deep pain of sadness, which is a healthy emotion, you're able to think through it. And that's why things like, you know, grieving, which effectively feels like depression to the person, it's still a curative and healthy process for humans. It actually is adaptive rather than maladaptive, whereas depression is not. It's maladaptive because when you watch people in depression, they literally, their behaviors are not helping them. They can't get out of bed. They can't have relationships. They're just not functioning. And that's the way you know if an emotion is not serving someone well. So for instance, anxiety is unhealthy because your alertness is, you're over alert. Red alarms are going off everywhere. You don't know who's friend or foe. Whereas concern is a healthy negative emotion where you're focused on the more probable targets and more probable threats. So you're not going to act impulsively.
Yeah.
And again, that's, concern is resting upon logical statements, you're using falsification to determine what is based in reality and what's not. You're not reactive, you're proactive.
Yeah.
So again, I believe the emotions that erupt from building deep, rational, internal philosophy will have a lot of richness. I mean, I believe just from myself feeling them is the case. Now, I understand from the outside, it sounds like words like rational and sounds very robotic and sterile. And I get that. And it's frustrating to try to communicate this because I can empathize, I can imagine it through the eyes and ears, or mainly the ears of someone hearing this, that I get it. It sounds like you're going to deprive yourself of all the spice of life if you go down this path, but it's quite the opposite. You're really opening up a deep reservoir of emotion, like rich emotion, again, that you are building yourself. It's based on your story, not, again, I need approval and now I feel bad because someone told me I stole something and I got really pissed and started posting online. And then some people are agreeing with me. I felt good. And other people are disagreeing. And you're just a slave to the world. It sucks.
Yeah. And definitely. And I can say from my own experience that the way that I feel things and the way that I experience the world has completely changed and transformed since we've met. And since I started trying to put the things that you and all of this reading has taught me into practice.
Oh, I love hearing that. That's awesome.
I think this is a great place for us to wrap up this first episode because we are on 51 minutes.
Wow. Awesome. we didn't even get to dive into the Reddit thing, but that's
no,
cool.
No, we didn't even get to start. But I think this was really great and super useful because it really explained what you're talking about and the point of view that we're going to be approaching all of this from. So thank you so much for taking the time to share all of this with everyone.
My pleasure.
All right. We're going to go now, but we will see you guys all next week. And hopefully we'll be able to get to the Reddit stuff that time. I'll talk
Indeed.
To you later today.
I'm ready. Yeah, you're keeping me on track. Just start talking to me and I'll keep talking and tell me when to stop talking.
All right. We'll see you guys later. Bye.
All right. Later, everyone. Bye.